Jesus Christ, the master teacher, had just an incredible knack for being able to take a simple story and communicate some of the most profound truth. And I don't know of any other story that possibly is the most confusing, if you're not careful, but maybe also the most poignant of all the stories that Jesus told, and the one of the money manager in Luke chapter 16. And I want us to look at the words of Jesus this morning in Luke chapter 16 and see this incredible story that he told and learn some lessons from it. It's the story of the smart bad manager. In Luke chapter 16, starting in verse 1, it says, Jesus told his disciples, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So we've got a wealthy man, landowner. He's got a manager taking care of his estate. The manager's wasting his money. Goes on to say, so he called him in and asked him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer. He's getting fired, laid off, surplused. Verse 3 says, the manager said to him, what shall I do now? My master's taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job, there will be people will welcome me into their houses. And this is what he does. So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400. Then he said to the second, and how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, take your bill and make it 800. Here's the twist, verse 8, the master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. Very, very interesting story. Now, in order to grasp the story, you got to kind of get back into an agrarian setting. And so this guy's managing the property and he's got debtors. These debtors are probably people that are using the land. In other words, someone subleases land to plant the wheat, and he's going to owe the master a certain percentage of the crop. In this case, he owes him 1,000 bushels. Somebody's going to sublet the olive grove, and he's going to harvest the olive trees, and because of that, he owes the master a certain percentage of the olive oil. And that's how the master makes his money. When the master finds out that his manager isn't doing a good job, he comes in to fire him, and the guy says, oh, what am I going to do? I don't have an income. I don't have a job. And so he comes up with this incredible plan. He goes to the first one, he says, cut your bill in half. Goes to the second one, says, cut 200 off your bill. What was he doing? Well, you know, for some of us, we would think this way. We would think, you know, if I'm going to be out of a job, then what I need to do is get as much money out of this deal as I can. And if I'm going to steal from the master, then I want to get the money. He could have gone to the first one and said, I'll tell you what you do. You cut your bill in half, and then you give me part of what's left over, and I'll take it for myself. He could have gone to the second one and said, hey, let's cut down your bill, but part of it is a kickback to me. But you know what the guy doesn't do? He doesn't take any money. And the master says that he is shrewd, smart, intelligent, and Jesus Christ says the same thing. Now, what makes this guy so shrewd? First thing you got to understand is what's the problem or what's the issue? The issue for this guy is his long-term future security. Notice what he says. In verse 4 it says, in verse 3 it says, the manager said to him, self, what shall I do? Now, my master's taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses. This guy recognized that implicating the debtors in his scheme would put them in a position where they were relationally in debt to him, and he came to the conclusion that it would be better to have friends long-term who would allow him to live with them than it would be to take the money and run. because the money will always run out. And Jesus, commenting on this, says, you know what? When it comes to practical business dealings, even the crooks of this world are smarter about what they're doing with their financial resources than the people of the kingdom. Now, do you want to find out why Jesus thinks that this guy is smarter than most of us when it comes to handling our money? Jesus goes on to explain. He gives two life lessons and a powerful lesson. The first one he gives in verse 9. When he goes on in verse 9 to say, I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Very interesting. Use worldly wealth in such a way that you will develop friendships that will invite you or welcome you into eternal dwellings. The first principle is that a wise use of money today can and will impact your future. A wise use of money today can and will impact your future. The shrewd guy said, this is not about money, this is about relationships. And what he did was he cut a financial deal, he used the resources that were available to him to cut a financial deal which would allow him to build relationships that would ensure that he had a place to live in the future. And what Jesus is saying is that we as people of the kingdom ought to understand that we ought to take the financial resources that we have and make sure that we're investing them today in such a way that in the future we will have secure relationships. Now that's true on two levels. One level is, do you want to pay for your care in your old age? Or do you want to have developed relationships with family members and friends through your generosity and your contribution to their life, so that there are people there that care about you in the end? There are people that are there for you when you need help. It's a great question. Many people, in an attempt to keep and hoard all that they have, spend their life alienating people. Work associates, business associates, stepping on people's necks, one-upping the neighbors, putting people down, turning off relationships in the family and squabbles over money. And by the time it's all over, they end up with just their stuff. And there's nobody else there. Other people spend their life in generosity, using whatever resources God gives them to build friendships and relationships. And they always have someone to take care of them because there's always people that love them. That's on a temporal level. Just makes good sense. But Jesus makes a twist here. He calls it eternal dwellings. Notice what he says at the latter part of verse 9. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. When the world is done, when your wealth is gone, when all that's left behind, what will your heavenly home look like? Jesus said that there's a connection with what you do with your money today and the dwelling that you're going to be in the future. And we'll come back to that principle in just a second, but let me make one more principle that Jesus makes from this passage. Second principle Jesus makes from this passage is that money is a minor. Money is a minor that reveals your attitude toward the majors. Of all the issues in life, Jesus Christ says, finances, money, is a very small thing. But it is a very powerful indicator of how you view the rest of life. Notice what Jesus says in verse 10. He says, whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. Whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. Now, what are you talking about, Jesus? He goes on in verse 11 and says, so, if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth. So he's equating worldly wealth with that which is very little, a very minor, small responsibility in all of life. He says, if you've not been trustworthy in handling wealth, who will trust you with true riches? Who will trust you with that which is more important, the majors in life? He goes on to say, in verse 12, and if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? Now what's he making reference to? He's making reference to the fact that the master owns it, and he gives his manager a responsibility to manage his stuff well, the manager doesn't handle it well and loses his job. In the same way, God owns all the stuff that we have. He gives us our financial resources to manage them well. If we can't handle the little things of life, like the money that God sends our way, how will God entrust us with kingdom rewards, with kingdom responsibilities, with kingdom blessings? Sometimes we pray, God, use me. Do something big through me. Use me. And God says, you know what? I've given you just this little responsibility to take care of my finances and use them in a way that's pleasing to me, and you're not doing good with that. Why do you keep praying for me to use you on the major issues of life? Some wonder why God doesn't seem to really help you when it comes to the big things. Relationship with your spouse, relationship with your kids, evangelization, being used in a significant ministry. And you wonder why it seems like people less gifted and people less intelligent and people less motivated are actually making a bigger contribution to life, seem happier, seem more blessed. People that are a lot further down the scale on finances seem to be enjoying things and seem to things be going well for them, and you wonder, why, God, why do you treat them so well? Maybe this is the answer. And God says, well, you know, I've given you this minor responsibility, finances. You handle it poorly. Why do you think I would trust you with true riches? And then Jesus comes back to a statement that he's made before in Matthew in verse 13. He says, no one, no servant, can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Those two taskmasters are mutually exclusive. If you make a prior commitment to the minor, to serving stuff, finances, getting things, acquiring things, being able to have lots of, at least from where you're coming from, lots of stuff, if that's what you're committed to, you will not be able to, at the same time, have a heart commitment that serves God. You cannot do them both. Now, that's what Jesus is saying. So people that get wrapped up in worshiping this world, which is a form of idolatry, worshiping the stuff of this world, will not be able, they will not be available to put their heart, to put their focus on God. So what you do with the minor thing, money, reveals an awful lot about your attitude. Reveals a lot about your attitude about who God is, about the future, about priorities, what's important in life, what's not important. It reveals a lot about your attitude toward people and what you think about people and relationships. It reveals a lot about your attitude about the kingdom of Jesus Christ and reaching the lost and expanding the kingdom. It reveals a lot about what you believe about trust and who's the source of your life versus self-reliance. It reveals a lot about selfishness versus selflessness. And this one little area, this area called money, reveals a ton about what the big issues of life mean to you. Now, I love this next verse here because this just fits so characteristically with this discussion. Okay, look really carefully at what he says next. The Pharisees, who loved money, heard all this, and they were sneering at Jesus. What's always interesting is that any time the discussion of money and spirituality comes up, or giving and investing in the kingdom of Jesus Christ, there are always going to be people who turn up their nose. Sneering literally means turn up their nose, roll their eyes, and go, here we go again, and have a critical attitude. Isn't that interesting? And he tells us the reason why people get that way. The Pharisees, who love money, they sneer at any attempt to connect money and spiritual commitment. Why? Because they've already made a prior commitment. And even the comparison, the thought about being asked to participate, the thought about being asked to give, the thought about even being asked to be generous, to obey what Jesus is saying, that makes them upset. And so they mock and they sneer and they get critical. Jesus Christ here morphs into the Jim Baker in their mind because he's talking about the one area that should never be discussed. Why? because if you talk about this, I might have to deal with it. And I don't want to deal with it because that's my master. I've committed to it. And you can't serve both God and money. It's funny, but in just about every discussion where there are people present where Jesus is talking about money, something like this comes up. Remember last week we were talking about the woman who came and anointed Jesus at Bethany and she broke the alabaster box of perfume and poured it on Jesus Christ. And what happened immediately? People started criticizing. And it's funny because in our giving campaign, I've had a few people come up to me and say, Tim, I just can't understand this. I'm so excited about what God's doing. I'm so excited about the possibility of me participating. I'm so excited about the prayer process. But I ran into some people, and they just kind of rolled their eyes and sneered. And I don't understand that. And you know what I say to that? This has been going on from the time of Jesus Christ. What that means is that they're under conviction. That's a really positive thing. Because that gives Christ an opportunity to win the victory. Notice what Jesus says to the Pharisees. He said to them, "You are the ones who justify yourself in the eyes of men." Most criticism, I would suggest, most criticism of talking about financial stewardship is an attempt to justify yourself in the eyes of men. You are the ones who justify yourself in the eyes of men, but God knows your hearts. What is highly valued among men is detestable in God's sight. Ooh, that's a strong warning. In other words, many of the things financially that we really think are valuable, when God looks at them, He says, you know, that is just worthless. It's detestable. It is a waste. Now, having looked at this incredible parable, where Jesus says, oftentimes, the people of this world who are non-Christians understand more about the temporal value of material things, that they have a short shelf life, that life doesn't consist in them, and so they use them in order to better their position in this life. He says, we of all people ought to be the kind of people that understand that material things have a short shelf life, they will never last beyond this life, and we ought to use them not only to better our position in this life, but also, we know that we have a life to come, we ought to do that to better our position in the life to come. Which brings us back to the passage that we've been looking at as our theme passage for the great investment in 1 Timothy chapter 6. So leaving the words of Jesus, let's turn back to the words of Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 6. Starting in verse 17, we recognize that God owns it all and it all belongs to Him and He's the one who gives it to us, and He gives it to us for a very important reason, and that is good. It's not negative, it's not difficult, it's positive. Notice what it says in verse 17. He says, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. So God is a source. God gives us our wealth. He richly provides what we have. And it says in this passage that He gives it to us not only to meet our needs, but to do two additional things. And I love the first one. It's really good. Notice in verse 17, He says, He gives it to us for our enjoyment. In other words, if you have more than enough to meet your needs today, you ought to enjoy it. You ought to be happy about that. You ought to be grateful. Rather than looking ahead and saying, well, I don't have as much as the guy next door. I don't have as much as the guy in Fortune magazine. If you've got more than enough for today, you ought to be happy and thankful and enjoy it. Because God wants you to enjoy it. He's giving you the extra to enjoy. Second thing God tells us to do with it is to invest it. Notice in verse 18. He says, command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, to be generous and willing to share, literally, to be eager to share, to be fast about sharing, to be the one who's looking for ways to use their financial resources to advance the kingdom of Jesus Christ, to meet people's needs, to better other people. In other words, we should not be measured in how much we can amass and hold, but we should be measured in how often and how frequently our hearts are moved by God to help other people out, to invest in His kingdom, to be generous and meet needs. That's what pleases God. So God gives us our needs. He gives us extra to enjoy. You don't have to worry about, I've got an extra nickel today, so I've got to find a poor person to give this away to, or God's going to zap me. That's not the attitude. He gives us extra to enjoy. Some of it we ought to use to enjoy ourselves, but we also ought to be looking on a regular basis for places to invest our resources. And that's what God is saying to us. I want you to understand, God is not telling us this because God is cash poor. He owns it all. He's not saying it because He's trying to find a way to finagle you into giving Him something for His benefit. God doesn't need your money. But what God has chosen to do is to use you and use me in a process of giving so that we can be blessed. And this passage goes on to say that there are two very significant benefits that you and I have when we're generous. And if we're not generous, we're going to miss these blessings. We're going to miss these benefits. So here's the upside of giving. The benefits, the blessings that come to you. Here's the good stuff. Notice what he says in verse 19. He says, in this way, in what way? Well, in the way that he just described in verse 18. Generous, willing to share, eager to give, looking for places to invest. For people who do this, that's their way of life, that's their lifestyle. Two significant blessings are going to come your way. Here's the first one. He says, in this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age. You will lay up treasure for yourselves as a firm foundation for the coming age. Here's the principle, that if I invest in God's kingdom, what will happen as a result of that is it secures a solid footing when I stand before Jesus Christ. It secures a solid footing when I stand before Jesus Christ. Literally, he says, that if you take your treasure and you invest it in the things of God, that the result of that is you are storing up for yourself treasure as a firm foundation, a good place to stand, a solid footing for the coming age. Now, what is the coming age referring to? It's referring to the kingdom of Jesus Christ. When we stand in His presence and enter into His kingdom, we will either enter His kingdom on solid footing or we will enter His kingdom on shaky ground. You say, well, what does that mean? I mean, how does that work? Well, the Bible's very clear that when we take our financial resources and use them for the kingdom of Jesus Christ, that there will be rewards in the life to come for doing that. Let me give you just a couple quick verses. In Matthew 10:42, Jesus says, if anyone gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones, because he is my disciple, I tell you the truth, he will certainly not lose his reward. In other words, Jesus is paying attention to every single act of generosity on your part. And even something as simple as giving a cup of cold water to someone who needs it as an act of worship, as you being one of Jesus' disciples, he says that is a rewardable activity that in the life to come, Jesus will remember that and reward you. Let me give you another example. In Luke 14:12-14, Jesus is telling people, when you throw a feast and you have a banquet, don't invite the people that are wealthy, because what they'll do is they'll turn around and they'll invite you to their dinner party and you'll have your reward. He says, go out and find the lame, the crippled, and the poor and bring them in your home and feed them. And here's what he says. He says in verse 14, although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. There will be a day when what you do to help other people at the resurrection of the righteous, when the righteous stand before God, that God's going to reward you for what you did. Listen to the words of Paul in Philippians 4:17. He says, not that I'm looking for a gift. He just received a gift from me. He says, not that I'm looking for a gift. I am looking for what may be credited to your account. You see, here's the way it is. What God is doing is He's keeping track of where all of His money goes. And He's given out credit or rewards for how it gets used. And so when you take all the money that God's given you and you take some of that and you invest it in His kingdom, He's keeping track of that. And He's going to bless you and reward you for what you use to advance His kingdom. And when you don't invest and you take all that God gives you and you just hoard it up for you, it's all about you, you're missing out on that, and God's not having anything to record positively about what you're doing with His money. You're not managing it according to His principles. And so what does that look like to be on solid footing? Well, I liken it to an occasional Saturday morning when one of us gets up and says, okay, kids, here's the deal. Clean the house. We're going to go get donuts. I'll be back in a few minutes. And when I get back, I want to have, you know, this picked up and this room swept and this stuff mopped and dusted, and I'll be back in a little while. I'm coming home. And Cindy heads out the door. I head out the door. And when we come back with the reward, you know, the Krispy Kreme, unfortunately it's usually H-E-B, but what kind of footing will my kids be on? Well, if they did what they were told, If they picked up their stuff, they vacuumed the floor, did their dusting, if they did what they were supposed to be, when we walk in with the reward, man, you got kids that are proud of themselves. Hey, look what we did. Look at the contribution we made. We were obedient to you. We did what we were supposed to do. They're on solid ground. And the reward is there. But what happens if, you know, brothers and sisters squabble and they argue about, well, you know, it's your job to vacuum, not mine. Well, I'm not going to do it. And the next thing you know, TV comes on. Everybody's sitting around. What footing do they have to stand on when we come home? We walk in the house and everybody's got their head down. Everybody's wondering, am I going to get one of those donuts? Bad footing. There's nothing to show for what you were requested and commanded to do. The same thing is going to be true when we stand in the presence of Jesus Christ. You'll either stand there with a stockpile of investments that you've made, and you'll be on solid footing as a steward or a manager of God's money. You'll stand there and you'll say, man, I am so proud of myself. You gave me 5 talents. Look, here's 5 more. Or you'll stand there and say, I don't have a lot to show for what I did with my life. I don't have a lot to show for what I did with your resources. One of the greatest blessings and benefits that Paul tells us about giving financially is that we're laying up treasures in heaven, and when we stand before Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, we have something to show for what we did with His stuff. The second benefit is also seen here in this passage. He goes on to say in this way, they will lay up treasures for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that, you know, if they do this, they lay up these treasures in heaven, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. That's a very, very important statement. What he's saying is that there is a type of life that many people live that is not real life. It's not the real thing. It's a pseudo-life. We talked about it before. Remember when Jesus said that a man's life does not consist of his possessions? In other words, if we get our focus on that life consists in what I can acquire or what I can hold, and that is what gives me joy, that's what gives me peace, that's what gives me security, that's what makes life better, if that's my point of view, then I'm living a life that's not really life. The life that God has given us is a life of freedom, a life of joy, a life of relationships, a life of trust, a life of faith, a life of confidence. And those two lives are incompatible with each other. So the question is, which of those two types of lives are you living? Are you taking a hold of a pseudo-life, or are you embracing that life which is truly life? The problem is that we've been bitten, according to Randy Alcorn, by the affluenza bug. And giving is the antidote, it is the cure to the affluenza bug. You say, well, how would I know if I have affluenza? Well, let me give you some of the symptoms. Okay? Here you go. I'm going to go fast. You worry about money. You ever worry about money? That's one of the symptoms. You have stuff that you don't really have time to use. I remember when we decided we're going to save a lot of money on vacations. So we went out and spent several $100 buying camping equipment that we've used twice. Now, why in the world did we do that? Well, because that's what you do. You go out and buy it, and you put it in the garage. And I just wonder how many millions of dollars the Coleman Company has stored away in our garages. You know, people say, well, I bought that boat, and I just, you know, when am I going to have time to use it? You buy stuff that you really don't have time to use, and it sits around. Things seem like a good investment at the time. You constantly say that to yourself. Well, it seemed like it was going to be something worthwhile at the time. How about this one? Shopping is a hobby. Okay, 50% of you are really mad at me right now. Shopping is a hobby. Looking for things to acquire is a hobby. Here's another one. You fight about money at home. You have fights about money. How about you get really excited about a purchase? I mean, you really get excited. Like when you're thinking about buying something, that runs through your mind. You just think about it, and you think about it, and you think about it, and you think about it. It's just something you're thinking about a lot, and it goes through your mind over and over again. It's a thing. But you think about it a lot. How about earning more money is a big career motivator. You may give up a job that you really love because the other one that you don't love at all and you don't even think is going to be fun is going to pay a lot more money. That is a symptom of being bitten by the influenza bug. How about you break your own financial priorities? You set priorities for yourself, and pretty soon, you break them. So the things you commit yourself to, you're not even keeping. How many of you set a budget, and then something came along that looked good, and there goes the budget out the window? You're breaking your own priorities. Affluenza. If you want something really bad, you buy it on credit without ever thinking about what it's going to end up costing you by the time you get it paid off. Oh, it's on sale, so I'm going to put it on credit. By the time it's over, I will have paid 20% more than if I had paid full price for it. But I don't even think about that because I need it, I want it, I got to get it. Your purchases always cost more than you originally anticipated. How many of us have gone into the dealership? I'm not going to pay more than this for a car. And we walk out, and it's got this extra and this upgrade and this upgrade and this upgrade. And we're scratching our head going, boy, you know, it was all making sense, but how in the world did I spend 25% more than what I'd committed to before I went in there? Affluenza. Certain in things become a necessity. It's really amazing. I think the most common one today is really amazing to me, is 10 years ago, only the rich, wealthy, or business people owned a cell phone, and life went on. It's amazing to me how many people tell me how important and necessary a cell phone is for survival. I mean, as if it's not even safe to be alive. I mean, what if something goes wrong? Well, you know, what if something went wrong before? But things that are in, They all of a sudden become a necessity. Everybody's got to have one, and I've got to have one because everybody's got to have one of these. It's necessary. Here's one of the telling ones. Your kids have more than you ever dreamed of having at their age, and they appreciate it less. They have more today than you ever dreamed of having when you were at their age, and they don't really appreciate what they have. That's affluenza. It's rampant in our culture today, and what I would suggest to you is that giving is an antidote to this virus called affluenza. You know, most of us don't really believe that money doesn't make the world go round. In the face of many wise people that had lots of it, let's say it doesn't. Let me give you some examples. I'm going to go through these very quickly. How about the Vanderbilt, W.H. Vanderbilt? One time made a statement, the care of $200 million is enough to kill anyone. There's no pleasure in it. John Jacob Astor once said, I am the most miserable man on earth. These were wealthy men of yesteryear. John D. Rockefeller said, I have made many millions, but they have brought me no happiness. You say, pass them my way. Andrew Carnegie, at one time known as the most wealthy, the richest man on the face of the planet, said, millionaires seldom smile. Henry Ford once said, I was happier when I was doing the job of a mechanic. Now Solomon, the richest man that ever lived, said similar things about his wealth. I want you to notice what he said in Ecclesiastes 5. He said, the more you have, the more you want. In other words, whoever loves money never has enough. He says, the more you have, the less you're satisfied. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. The more you have, the more people, including the government, will come after it. Ecclesiastes 5:11, as goods increase, so do those who consume them. He says, the more you have, the more you realize it does you no good. Ecclesiastes 5:11 says, and what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? Ecclesiastes 5:12, the more you have, the more you worry about. The sleep of a laborer is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of a rich man permits him no sleep. I mean, what's happening in Tokyo? How's that going to affect my portfolio? Got to worry about it. Ecclesiastes 5:13, the more you have, the more you can hurt yourself by holding on to it. I've seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner. Ecclesiastes 5:14, the more you have, the more you have to lose, or wealth lost through some misfortune. And ultimately, Ecclesiastes 5:15, the more you have, the more you'll leave behind. Naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labor that he can carry in his hand. That's the condition of people who have affluenza. They believe that life consists in stuff. I wonder if you've learned the lesson of the dominoes, or if you're living the life of the dominoes. You ever play with dominoes, you know, kind of stack them up in a row, and then you make your little configuration, and then you push on one of them, and you watch the whole thing tumble, and it kind of makes this cool little deal? What happens when someone comes along and teeters one in the middle before you're ready to push him over? I mean, there's nothing you can do. If one of them starts to fall, it takes the whole thing down. And many of us, financially, are living that kind of a lifestyle. I mean, when you think about it, we set ourselves up in such a way that the dominoes all have to be standing. You know, I've got to make a certain amount of money. I've got to keep this job because I went out and I purchased this house, and that puts me in a position where I got these big house payments. And then in addition to that, you know, I need these cars, and so I purchased these cars, and then, you know, my kid needs braces, and so I need to do that. And in addition to that, I've got this college fund that I've got to support. And, you know, then everybody in the family wanted to do this really nice vacation, because at some point in your life, every single person is deriving their kids if they don't take them to a certain place in Florida. So I got to do this whether I can afford to or not. So I got that set up. And, you know, then the furniture was on sale. So I bought that. And pretty soon, you got all the dominoes set up. And then you got to keep them all standing. Because what if one falls? You know, I got termites in the house. Oh, my goodness. What are we going to do now? Or the car breaks down. Oh, my goodness. What am I going to do? Or my health fails. Or I get surplused at work. And so all the time, if any one of these dominoes falls, the whole world falls. Is it no wonder that in the study of marriages that have failed, 90% of the people say money was one of the main things that they argued about? Because if one goes over, then all of life goes over. And you know what Jesus said to that? Jesus said, you know, if you have to worry about more than today, you're in a bad spot. Because tomorrow has enough trouble of its own. Some of us have 30 years of today that are riding on our back right now. Because if this falls, then I won't be able to do this. And if this doesn't pay, then I won't be able to do this. And if this breaks down, then I won't be able to do this. And it's all lined out. And everything is so nip and tuck. And it's living on the edge, on the margin all the time. And you know what? We hate that. Running, going, moving, wondering, you know, when something's going to fall apart and when it's all going to come crashing down. And you know what God says? God says, you're way overextended. You need to give some stuff away. Because what happens is when you start giving it away, you start focusing on the priorities of life, and so many of those things that were dominoes to you before are simply dominoes. They're not a big deal. And one of the greatest things that you'll do in your Christian life is become a generous person. Because it will give you a freedom from worry. It'll give you a liberation from material things. It will give you the ability to teach your children, to teach your kids what's really important. God will bless you for that. And that's why when we enter a time like the Great Investment, I don't have any problem whatsoever encouraging you to do what I did. Pray, seek God's will, and invest in the kingdom of Jesus Christ, because it's going to be the greatest way to invest your money. There's nothing that you will give your money to that's greater than giving it to the cause of Jesus Christ. It pays dividends now, it frees you now, and it gives you eternal rewards. And all that is to your betterment. That helps you. That makes life better. This week, in the process of our great investment, we're coming to our time of commitment. And what we're going to do this week is we're going to encourage everybody to have a family conference. And we had a family conference for our family before we made the commitment to give. And what I'd like to do, in just a symbolic act, is I'd like all of the heads of households that are here in the room, if you're a head of household, I'd like you to stand up, because I want to give you one charge. If you're a head of household, just stand up. What I'd like to ask you to do as the head of your household is this week you take personal responsibility to pull all your family together. If you're single, pull your kids together. If you have kids, just get your family together and sit down and ask God and ask yourself, God, what should we do to commit to the great investment? And you take responsibility to make that happen. And whatever God leads you to do, that's what you'll do. And that's all you do, whatever God asks you to do. And you take responsibility to do that this week. And I believe that God will honor that commitment and bless you in significant ways from taking the time to sit down, seek His will, and do what He tells you to do. Now, to remind us of why we're doing what we're doing, I'm going to give you one more taste of this. Y'all can sit down now. Thank you for standing. I'll give you one more taste of this, and then we'll be going to the gig. So let's be reminded one more time of why we're doing what we're doing.
God has given us a big vision at Hill Country Bible Church, but then He has a big vision Himself. God has a vision to reach the world. I mean, that's the command that He's given us: go into all the world and preach the gospel and make disciples. And so, as long as there are unreached people in Northwest Austin, there's still a job to be done.
There's a world out there that longs to know the truth and that needs to know the truth of God's love, and to see others know the truth and know how the truth can set them free and give them life. There's no price that we can put to that.
Think about the investment that God made in us. Now that, you know, He invested His Son in us. How can you beat that? There is no greater investment than the one God has made in us. So when He calls on us to make a great investment in His kingdom, who are we to hold anything back?
God brought me into His family through the ministry of Hill Country Bible Church. And there are probably a lot of other people in the congregation that have been brought into God's family through the ministry of Hill Country Bible Church. And my question to myself, as well as those individuals, is now what do we do? God has given us such an incredible gift through the salvation of Jesus Christ that we have not earned and we do not deserve.
When we really get a handle on what the Lord has done for us in terms of our salvation, thinking about opening our hearts to give is going to take on a different complexion, because we're looking at how great His grace was for us.
Jesus Christ has called us to invest in the kingdom, to invest in the things that He said was most important and He gave His life to.
God wants us to excel. He wants us to run the race. He expects us to step out there and push hard and make a difference. On our own, in the flesh, there's no way we can accomplish this. But through God's grace and through the power of the Holy Spirit and our willingness to submit to Him, all things are possible.
I'm just so excited about all of this. It's just such an opportunity for us to give something back to God and also to Hill Country for all the blessings that we've received through all these years. And just to know that someone else coming into the church to make a place for them, to expand the student ministry, to reach all these other children, to be a part of that for God is just so awesome.
In the last campaign, we were absolutely in awe at the end of the 3 years how God helped us to reach our commitment and go beyond it. We were absolutely amazed at what He could do with our income, because if you'd asked us at the beginning, we couldn't tell you where that money, those where any of that was coming from. We didn't know where it was coming from, and we just made the commitment because we felt that God wanted us to make that commitment. We were just amazed ourselves at what God did through us, just one little couple at Hill Country.
If your heart is in the right place and you're seeking the right treasure, then He can use you to do magnificent things, more than you can ever imagine.
In our case, God pushed us, we think, a little bit beyond our comfort level in our last giving campaign. But yet, if you look at our savings account before and our savings account after, we had more money when we finished giving. And we were able to pay for adopting twins, which is not cheap. We were able to pay for all those fertility treatments. We were able to buy a new home. It just blows me away how, on the financial side, God gave everything back, and that wasn't what we were expecting, and that's not what He promises, and I don't think anyone should expect that. And in my opinion, that's insignificant. What's significant is the blessings, the way that we grew close to God, the way that we learned true faith, and we learned that it's God that's going to deliver on His promises and deliver on answered prayers. And if God leads you to make a commitment, He's going to give you the resources to fulfill that commitment. He's going to take care of it. He's our Father.
As we are all prayerfully considering how God wants us to participate, we know that it's not going to be us that's making that decision. That through the process of prayer, as we have all been challenged to do, we are going to let the Lord work in our lives. He's going to tell us what we need to give. And if we're obedient and we submit to the Lord and we participate at the level that He wants us to participate, then we're honoring Him. We're glorifying Him.
This is going to be an exciting week as God speaks to each of us and God leads us through the great investment. And at this time, as we prepare to close our service, I'd like everybody to stand. And Doug's going to come up here and close us in prayer in just a minute. But for those of you who have not had a chance to attend one of our Nights of Vision or to come to one of our great investment gatherings, we're going to host one of those right now for about 40 minutes in the multipurpose building. And I'm going to head out the door, and for those of you who want to come, I encourage you to just follow me out now. For the rest of you, if you'll just stay here and give them a chance to get out, that way we can get started, and it'll be about 40 minutes. We're also going to do this after second service, so you could join us then, too. So I'm headed out the door, and those of you who want to come with us, come right now. We'll hurry on over there. Doug?